Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. What happens after the election? You took the time to vote, so now what happens to the issues that you care about? Especially when your party is in the minority, it can seem like your voice is not heard. Tonight on All Souls Forum, Representative Barbara Washington and Representative Judy Morgan will tell us about the process of creating and passing legislation and explain what can be done to impact change even when your party is in the minority. This show is recorded on March 17th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
The purpose of the forum is the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. What is happening in Missouri? The Kansas City metro area has some of the highest voter turnout in the state. We're showing up at the polls and electing strong, experienced, well-educated leaders to represent us in Jefferson City. Are we spinning our wheels? Do our representatives really get a chance to represent us? Are the metro areas being heard? This morning, we're going to hear from two legislators who continue to work hard to try to represent us against some pretty overwhelming odds. Representative Barbara Washington represents District 23 of the Missouri House. She was elected to the House in a special election in November 2017 and was reelected in 2018. In addition to being a state legislator, Representative Washington is a practicing attorney. Two of her primary passions are juvenile justice reform and mental health awareness. She regularly presents programs aimed to educate on small business development, minority mental health awareness, crime reduction, and environment preservation. Representative Washington is a graduate of the University of Missouri-Columbia School of Journalism. She obtained her Master's of Business Administration from Avila University and her Juris Doctorate from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Representative Judy Morgan represents District 23 in the Missouri House. She was first elected in a special election in November 2011. Representative Morgan is a member of the American Federation of Teachers, legislative chair of the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus, development officer of the Missouri Association of Social Welfare, and a KKFI Community Radio board member. Representative Morgan received her bachelor's degree in secondary education and a master's degree in guidance and counseling from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So we'll hear first from Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Linda. I really appreciate the introduction, and thank you for inviting me. I actually love my legislative district. It's District 24, and we're sitting right kind of in the middle of it here at All Souls. My district goes from the river to 47th Street, and then from State Line basically to Truce. So I take in most of downtown and all of the wonderful Midtown neighborhoods and then the whole west side of our city. Like I say, it's really a great district to represent. I'm just going to kind of go through the questions that Linda asked me to answer. And the first one she wanted me to answer is, what were your hopes and goals when you originally ran for your legislative seat? And I have to tell you, I never intended to run for a state rep. It was not on my radar screen whatsoever. You know, I had been a teacher and a counselor in the Kansas City Public Schools for 29 years, and then I was president of the Teachers Union for the Kansas City Public Schools for another 10 years. So at that point in my life, I'd actually worked 39 years, and the union president's job was really a very difficult job. And it was very, very long weeks. You never really got away from it, and by the time I retired, I was really just pretty much exhausted, so I needed some time off. So I never thought about running for a state rep, and then about 2 years later, after I had retired, my state rep, who was Jane Peters Baker, who is now our wonderful prosecutor, Jackson County prosecutor, decided she was going to, there was a resignation in the prosecutor office, and she decided to vie for that position, and she got it. So she had to resign, and she resigned in the middle of the term, so there was actually going to be a special election. Two of my very dear friends came up to me, and I remember it distinctly. It was at the inaugural picnic for Mayor Sly James. We were all there celebrating him winning his first mayoral election. And two of my friends came up to me and said, "Don't you live in Jean Peters Baker's district?" I said, "Yeah, I do." And they said, "We want you to run." And I said, "You've got to be kidding." I said, "I don't even like Jeff City." And but I tell you, the two people, one of them, and some of you may know her, she's no longer with us, it was Cherry Chaney. And the other one was Michelle Newby, who, and both of them are union folks. Cherry was a member of the Communication Workers of America, and Michelle is a firefighter who now lives in Texas. She left Kansas City to go to Texas. So both of those friends in my life would not give up on me because I initially said no, and they kept at me, and they tag-teamed. One would call me, and then the other would call me, and finally they convinced me to run. I have to tell you, when I first told my husband, he was like 100% supportive from day one. So that was a big help, too. So he encouraged me to run. So I, like many women, from what I've read from research, do not decide to run for elected office on our own. Even though I'd been a union president, I never thought about running for, you know, a state elected office. And this research says that most women generally wait until somebody, usually a good friend, somebody they respect, which was the case with me, two of my good friends, ask them to run, and then they decide to run. Thankfully, I think that's changing. I think women now are beginning to decide to run on their own without having to have that encouragement from others, so I'm very happy to see that. So I never intended to run, but I did. I ended up running during redistricting year, which meant that all of the districts were being redistricted. And to my luck, or bad luck probably, I got districted in with Mike Tallboy, who was our minority leader at the time. And so there was no way I was going to run against him. So I was there for a year and said, "Mike, I won't run against you. You've got one term left. I will run again after you are termed out." Well, then he got some big job offered to him in May of 2012, and he decided he wasn't going to run again, opened it up, so then I ended up being able to run right away. And so I ended up really liking the job. I like it a lot. So some of my hopes when I first came in is I really wanted to be a strong voice for my constituents. I think that's really important. Each of us in Jeff City represents about 34,000 to 36,000 people. And I think every single one of those voices need to be heard. So that was one of my hopes. Another hope I had was to make a difference. You know, as a teacher and a counselor, I really felt like I really did make a difference in the lives of some of my students. And then as union president, I worked with the teachers and all the school employees in the school district, and I felt like I made a difference in their lives. And as a state rep, I wanted to make a difference in the lives, you know, particularly of my constituents, but also really for all the citizens of Missouri. And then the last thing I wanted to do, or one of my hopes, was that we could effectively fight on the defensive. We're very much a minority as Democrats. I'm a Democrat, very much a minority in Jefferson City. So we have to spend a lot of time fighting on the defensive, and I wanted to be effective at that. So those were my hopes as I went in. So some of my goals, one of my goals, again, was to be a voice for my constituents and to speak out on the floor and in the Missouri House whenever there were issues that my constituents cared about. I remember one particular situation. It was my very first year down there, and our majority floor leader, who was Tim Jones at the time, and he then subsequently became speaker, he was talking about one of the it was a real anti-abortion bill he was talking about. And he got up and basically said that every Missourian felt the way he did. And that so utterly incensed me that he would say that I got up on the floor and I said, "I represent 34,000 people. And I said, I get a lot of emails on this issue. And I said, these emails are very much not in line with what the majority floor leader just said. I said, my 34,000 people, they deserve to be represented too. So I feel very strongly about that. That's one of our jobs, to represent what our constituents feel. The other thing that I think is really a goal is I always wanted to be I wanted to be able to understand the legislation. I wanted to know what was in the bills. I wanted to know what I was voting on. And then I wanted to be able to make responsible choices on those votes, taking into consideration what my constituents thought and what I thought. So that was important to me. The other thing I wanted to do is I wanted to support good legislation, whether it was carried by a Democrat or a Republican. And believe it or not, there is some good legislation that is put forth by Republicans. So there are times when you can support that legislation. I wanted to fight bad legislation because we do have bad legislation in the Missouri House. And then I also wanted to be well prepared whenever I spoke on the floor of the House and during committee meetings. Another goal I had is I really wanted to inform constituents. I think that's kind of part of me being a teacher. You know, as a teacher, you always want to educate folks. And so that was one of the things I really wanted to inform my constituents of what was going on in Jeff City. So to do that, one of the things, I have a weekly electronic update that I send out, and I have not missed one in my, now I'm in my eighth year in the legislature. I have not missed sending that out 1 week during session, which is January to May. And then during the off session, I send stuff out whenever there's something really important that comes up. I also do direct mailings. That's another way that I try to inform the people who live in my district. I do surveys. We're in the process of that survey. I should have gone out, and individuals will be sending it back, telling me what they think on some of the issues we're going to be talking about this session. I do a legislative summary at the end of each session. And our publications department provides a summary of the legislation, but they do like all the bills that have passed, and they do like one sentence about each one, and I think they're really pretty meaningless. So I always write my own legislative summary, and I pick out the bills that my constituents have really been concerned about, and I focus in on the 10 or 12 bills that they really care about. But I want to tell you kind of a funny story. I always would put down how I voted on the bill. So I'd have the summary of the bill, and then I'd say whether it passed or failed, and then I would tell how I voted on it. So a couple of years ago, my legislative assistant called me and she said, "Judy, I just got a call from publications and they're saying that you can't put how you voted on the bills." I said, "You've got to be kidding. I cannot tell how I voted on the bills. I'm not supposed to tell my constituents my vote." She says, "Yeah," she said, and I asked them, why don't you want to let Judy do that? And they said, "Well, if we let her do it, we'd have to let everybody do it." And I'm like, "Yes, that's true. I think everybody should put down how they vote." Well, I have a great legislative assistant, and she does not back down. And she went down to publications, and she said, "Oh, no, you will put down how Judy votes on the bills." So my votes are on there. But I really have to give a lot of credit to Sherry, because once she decides that, you know, this is the way it is and this is the right way to go, then she will go down, because this was during the summer, so I wasn't even in Jeff City. So she went down and took care of all of it for me. Another way I inform constituents is I always have the town hall meeting at the end of the session. I have a lot of fun at those. We talk about the important stuff that passed and the important stuff that failed. Other constituent outreach is really important. I think, you know, panels like this, I love to do things like this where I come and talk about the legislature. And then we do have, you know, individual constituents have issues, whether it's maybe they're not getting their Medicaid. And so we end up dealing with things like that. That's important to me, that we take care of all of the constituent needs. One thing that has been really hard about being in the legislature for me is that I truly like to win. I am one who likes to win. I don't like to lose. I really don't. I mean, I've been in a lot of different elections. When I was in my union, I was running for stuff all the time. I think I only lost twice for all the positions I ever ran for. Of course, I ran for union president 5 times and won every time. So I just don't like to lose. And unfortunately, in Jeff City, I lose sometimes on issues that I care about and issues that my constituents care about. And that's probably the hardest part about being down there. Okay, the next question Linda gave me is, are you finding what you expected? In other words, you know, when I went down to Jeff City, am I getting what I thought I was going to get? And really, pretty much I am. You know, as union president, I spent time in Jeff City. So I testified at hearings. You know, some of my members would testify at hearings. So I didn't walk in with rose-colored glasses. I knew that sometimes some of the reps and senators were really pretty rude and arrogant toward people who came down to testify, so I was aware of that. And I'd watch them actually put forth legislation that I thought hurt Missouri citizens. So it wasn't like there's some people that haven't been involved in that, new reps who come down, and they haven't been down to Jeff City before, and they get down there and they're pretty shocked kind of by the culture. It didn't really shock me because I'd actually seen it. It is difficult being in a deep minority. You know, there's 163 reps. Right now, as a Democrat, we have 47, so that's a very deep minority. And I have to say one thing I did not expect is I did not expect to drop to those numbers. When I first came in, we had 57 Democrats. We had a Democratic governor, and that's a very, the Democratic governor has the veto pen, and that is a very, very powerful tool in the legislature. So when we had 57 Democrats, when the Democratic governor, who was Jay Nixon, he vetoed some of the bad legislation, stuff that I thought was bad. And we had enough Democrats, because you only need a third to sustain the governor's veto. So that means you only need 55 votes to sustain the governor's veto. We had 57. So as long as we stuck together, we could sustain any of those vetoes, which meant we could stop a lot of bad legislation. So that was 2012 when I got there. Then in the election later on that November, we actually lost 4 seats. We went down to 53, which meant we were now 2 below veto-proof. But we were still able, during that period, to get some Republicans to go along with us and still be able to sustain the governor's veto. And even when we got down to 45, because we hit a low of 45 in 2014, that was the year that we actually had 46 people win, Democrats, but the next day after the election, one of our Democrats became a Republican. So we went down to 45. But even then, we were actually able, we still had a Democratic governor, and we were actually able to sustain the vetoes on a lot of bad legislation. And in my opinion, we held off right to work during all that time. We held off a lot of bad educational policy. We held off some bad tax policy. And we were able to hold off a number of bills that would have weakened the union rights of public employees. So during the time we had a Democratic governor, even when our numbers were going down, we were able, working with some Republicans, to be able to stop some bad stuff from happening. But then in 2016, we did get up to 47, and that's what we're at now. We've got 47 Democrats out of 163. But we now have a Republican governor. And that really makes a huge difference. And the reason it makes a difference is because we've lost the power of the veto pen. Because of the governor being Republican and all the legislature being Republican, there's going to be very few bills that are vetoed. And some of those bills that get passed, in my opinion, are not good legislation, and we're not going to have the chance to veto them and then sustain the governor's veto. One thing, though, that's kind of interesting is once, a caucus, which is what we're called, we're a Democratic caucus, a Republican caucus, once a caucus gets really big, like they are now, which the Republicans having like 116 and we've got 47, almost inevitably when that happens, you have infighting among the majority caucus. And that's kind of what's going on right now. There's a lot of infighting among the Republicans. And it's kind of sad to say, but sometimes that can work to our advantage. Because sometimes if there's bad legislation that they're supporting, and one example, we had a bill that we've been dealing with the last month on expansion of charter schools into other parts of the state. And a number of the Republicans do not want charter schools in their districts because they feel like their public schools are good and they don't think they have a need for charter schools. So this did create a pretty big fight among the Republicans, and it was pretty brutal. They were a lot of arm twisting, trying to give different things to people to get their vote. But eventually, that charter school bill was supposed to be brought up on Wednesday for a vote on the floor of the House, and it was not because we don't think they have the votes yet. So that's kind of an example where sometimes when a caucus gets so big, it's really hard for them to move forward because they have so much divergence within their own caucus. Another thing that kind of expectation, I think some folks, when they come into the legislature, they think they're going to get their bills are all going to sail through with no problems. And the reality is a lot of times Democratic bills do not pass through the House. You know, it's mostly the Republican bills that pass. John McCain, I read a quote from him once, which I thought was pretty astute, where he said it was during the time that they were working on the Affordable Care Act. You know, at that time Obama was, a Democratic president. He had a Democratic House and Senate. So they were able to get the Affordable Care Act through. And John McCain said, what you all have to realize is that the party that's in power is the party that gets to govern and make the laws. And there really is truth to that. Whichever party is in power, they're the ones that kind of run the legislative program. That's just a reality you have to deal with. So some people who have come in and they don't know that, they are so disappointed when their bills don't get, assigned to committee right away and get to the floor. But those of us who have kind of more of an understanding, we know that this is just the way it is. There are other ways, though, to get your bills to move forward. You can get them amended onto somebody else's bill. You know, you can go to another Republican and say, would you support this bill and do it? So there are other ways to do it, but you've got to find other ways. It's not going to be the traditional way. And one thing that I did not expect to find, and this is kind of terrible to say in a way, is I didn't think I would meet very many Republicans that I would like. But and I'm just being honest because I'm this Democrat that lives in this 83% Democratic area in Kansas City. And anyway, but, I found some Republicans that I like, and I respect them, and they are people I can work with. And generally, they are either the pro-public education Republicans or the pro-labor union Republicans. And I found that they, I can work with them. But interestingly, I have also found a few that are just totally right-wing wackos that I actually like. I know that sounds crazy to say, but I like them. There's one particular guy who, in terms of issues, he and I are on total polar opposites. Probably just about every important issue, we are on a total polar opposite. And he gets up on the floor and says the craziest things sometimes about issues like, reproductive rights. And yet he is the most gentlemanly, nice man who is always so friendly and always smiles and says hello to me and how am I doing. And so he's really very likable, even though his policies are very, very different from what I think. And I think that was something I wasn't expecting, so that's kind of interesting. The next question was, does the division between the Democratic elected officials and Republican elected officials seem to have any hope of mending in the near future? We're living in really very partisan times. We probably all know that. I serve on the Elections Committee this year. It's my first year being on the Elections Committee. I really love it. It's a very interesting committee to be on. I'm learning a lot. And we had a bill that some of the county clerks came up and testified on. And there were four or five of them, and some of them, some of them were Republican persuasion, some of them were Democratic persuasion, so they were from both sides of the aisle. And all of them said they could not, that the hostility among voters in the 2018 election was so much more than the hostility among voters in the 2016 election at the polls. So their election judges were having to deal with a lot of hostility in 2018 that they didn't have to deal with in 2016. And I was kind of surprised by that because, my polling place is over at the Central Presbyterian Church at 35th and Campbell. I know this is a polling place here at All Souls. And the polling places in my area seem to be, I don't think we had those problems, but there's other areas of the state where I guess there's a lot of hostility, and I think it's because of our political discourse and what's going on right now. That's my thinking. But I thought that was interesting. So It's like the partisanship has gone beyond just the elected officials, I think, to the rank and file voters. Does that make sense? It's like kind of permeated down to the rank and file voters. So I don't think we're going to see an end to the partisanship anytime soon. My husband kind of has this philosophy, whoever's at the top of the organization, that's kind of what filters down to everybody else. And I think when we have a president who has, you know, I'm going to show my partisanship here, but when we have a president who, you know, talks the way he does, that kind of filters down. And I think until we have somebody at the top that can be more of a unifier and more of a person who is tolerant and kind, we're probably going to be in this partisan area. That being said, though, again, I do have to say, you know, at the State House, there are times when we as Democrats and Republicans do work together. It's not like we're fighting 100% of the time. We do fight some of the time, but we don't fight 100% of the time. Sometimes we actually do get along on issues, and sometimes even it's like the Democrats pretty much are solid behind a particular issue, and the Republicans are the ones fighting on that issue, like, say, the charter schools. Or the other night, we had a bill on oral contraceptives, and what it would have done, it would have allowed women 18 years and older, after they have their first visit with their doctor, to have a prescription for birth control pills that was ongoing. So they wouldn't have to go back to the doctor every year to get the prescription for birth control pills. This bill was brought forth by a Republican woman. She did a great job on the floor. Sheila Solon is her name. She's from the St. Joe area. The divide on it was on the Republican side. We had one Republican get up and basically say birth control was abortion, and you should not support this bill because it was abortion. And I will tell you, Sheila took him on, and she did a great job on it. So sometimes it's not the infighting, is like I said before, it's actually among within the own party too. So, but that bill ended up passing, but about 45 people voted against it, so it was like 110 to 45, something like that. And all 45 people who voted against it were Republicans. No Democrat voted against it. They supported the Republican bill. So that's just kind of interesting, I think. Then the last one was, she says, why do you stay and have your goals changed now that you are in the legislature? Well, I think I do stay for the same reasons I ran, because I want to be a strong voice and I want to make a difference. John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, happens to be one of my heroes and someone I really idolize. And I know he said, this is a quote he said that I just love. He says, never give up, never give out, and never give in. And that's kind of what I take to the legislature, is I think our viewpoints need to be represented, and we can never give up on those. You probably have heard about a prescription drug monitoring program. This is an electronic database that the patients, all the drugs that they're taking is put into this electronic database. And then when you go to the doctor, your doctor can look that up so to make sure that he or she doesn't prescribe you something that would be contrary to what you're already taking. Missouri is the only state that does not have a prescription drug monitoring program. All other 49 states have it. It's been put forth in the House a number of times. It has passed out of the Missouri House a number of times. It has been stopped over on the Senate side. A particular senator named Senator Shaw from St. Joseph would always say that he would filibuster it so the Senate side would not bring it up. He's gone. He was termed out. So we are hopeful this year we may be able to get this through. It's already passed in the House. It actually came out of the House maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. So it's got plenty of time on the Senate side to make it through at this point. So hopefully we will be the last state in the nation to have a prescription drug monitoring program. And there's really two reasons why it's important. One reason is that some people kind of doctor shop. You know, they maybe get addicted to pain pills. Of course, the opioids is one of the most serious challenges we're facing right now in terms of drug addiction in the state. So they get addicted, and then their doctor doesn't want to give them anymore, so then they'll go to another doctor and get some, and then they'll just maybe have three or four doctors, and the doctors don't have any way of knowing that they're doing that unless they self-divulge. If we had the PDMP, the doctor would have a way of knowing that because they could look at the database and see that the person already had two prescriptions for this just, you know, 3 days ago. So that's one reason that a PDMP is a good thing, in my opinion. The other reason is some people actually go to doctors to get drugs to sell on the streets. One of our reps who was termed out was pretty, he would always bring up the story. He was from St. Francis County, and he would bring up the story of the 80-year-old grandmother who was actually doing just that. She was going to the doctor, getting drugs, and then selling them on the street for extra cash. So it does happen. So those are the two things that a PDMP can avoid. The other one I talked about, the oral contraceptive bill, I think that was a good bill that hopefully we can get through. And interestingly, we have quite a bit of bipartisanship for criminal justice reform. We just passed a bill a couple of weeks ago that would adjust mandatory minimum sentencing. Right now, there's certain crimes where judges are told, this is the mandatory minimum sentence you can give for this particular crime, without looking at any other, like the age of the defendant, you know, whether violence was involved, whether maybe treatment might be a good or better idea than sending the person to jail. So we had a bill that passed in the House that says judges will now have more flexibility. They will not have to do those mandatory minimums unless it's a violent crime or a crime that involves firearms. But otherwise, you know, they can go ahead and use some discretion on the judge's part. These mandatory minimums were put in primarily during the time we had the war on drugs, and they thought a lot of people should just get a really big sentence because of, you know, use of drugs. But a lot of people that are using drugs probably need treatment rather than jail time. So that was really, I thought, something, a move forward. And interestingly, I thought this was pretty funny. Before we debated that bill on the floor, I just looked at my email, and I'd gotten an email from Americans for Prosperity. And it's sort of a libertarian slash conservative organization. And they sent us this email saying, we want the reps to vote for this mandatory minimum sentencing bill, and we will likely use it as one of our recorded votes. So that means they would be looking at it and judging us on that vote. So when I got up on the floor to talk to the sponsor about it, I kind of mentioned that, I think I probably have a zero with the Americans for Prosperity, but probably with this vote, I'm going to gain some points from them because they support it. So there has been kind of this interesting libertarian, conservative, liberal coming together on criminal justice reform. So yeah, so that was a good thing. I'll just real quickly highlight a couple of other things. You probably have heard about the fetal heartbeat bill. That's a really bad bill that would basically outlaw abortion in Missouri eventually, because it's got one of the clauses in it that says if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, then abortion will immediately become outlawed in the state of Missouri. We think this bill is obviously unconstitutional, but we think the intent is they want to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court. So they want a test case to take to the U.S. Supreme Court to outlaw abortion. We're having troubles with keeping the minimum wage. You know, we passed the minimum wage by 62% in Missouri in November, and there are some onslaughts on that. And with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Barb Washington, my colleague from the 23rd District.
This question is for both representatives. I think I'm a little bit confused about the role of the state in education and the role of individual school districts. So who has what responsibility, and how does this affect whether or not we might possibly think about pre-K statewide or something like that? Could you talk a little bit about where we're at on all that subject?
Judy is the education expert. I'll briefly speak and then let her answer that as a former educator. Pre-K is not, first let's start with, the U.S. Constitution has never guaranteed anyone the right to education. The Missouri State Constitution, I believe, does have education, but that starts at kindergarten. So pre-K is not a responsibility of the state. However, we are attempting to move some money from the budget for pre-K education. It probably may not get through, but we are working on that, and that everything in the budget has to be somewhat bipartisan because, as you know, they outnumber us. With respect to the local school districts, that's something that they are welcome to take up. The foundation formula does not include any pre-K.
Okay, we can just share. Thank you. Yeah. The state actually doles out a certain amount of money. They have to spend at least 25% of the total general revenue budget on education. I believe they are spending more than that. They do set up a foundation formula of how much money they're going to give to the school districts. They do set up the accreditation standards that goes through the state. So in terms of whether a school is unaccredited, provisionally accredited, or fully accredited, that is the state that comes in and makes those evaluations. So the state does all of that kind of thing. If a school does come under the unaccredited status, the state comes in and sets up help for that school district to hopefully bring it back to accreditation status. That's what went through with the Kansas City Public Schools. They had a lot of involvement with the state, where the state came in with committees and worked on issues to help them get accreditation back. So the state does all of those kind of broad things, but the local school district is supposed to do everything like hiring the superintendent, setting their own salaries, although there is a minimum state teacher salary that is in effect, that you have to pay this much, but school districts can pay more. In terms of curriculum, programs, the local school district hiring, they are actually supposed to take care of all of those issues. Although the other night we had an amendment put on a decent education bill that said no superintendent could be paid more than the governor's salary. So that was kind of a way to take away some local control from the school district. Barb's correct in terms of it is a K-12 foundation formula, although a bill was passed, I think in 2014, that said we could fund a partial amount of preschool funding. It's not enough to fund every kid in the districts. It's up to 4% of your free and reduced lunch. You can have that many kids. So if you had, 6,000 kids on free and reduced lunch in your district, 4% of 6,000, is that 240? Is that right? Something like that. So you could only have funding for 240 of your early childhood kids. Most districts probably would have more than that. But you have to have a fully funded foundation formula to do that, which we do have now. So we are supposed to be funding up to 4% of the free and reduced lunch for early childhood. Does that kind of answer it, or do you still have some other? Not really. Okay.
I'd like to ask a question not about a legislative substance, but a procedure.
Okay.
It's my experience in the Missouri legislature that there's not a lot of staff support for committees, that the seniority system maybe isn't very effective, the accommodations, particularly for reps, are very meager. You have to often double up in very small offices. So these are procedural questions that I wonder if you could just generally answer and say if you could improve how the legislature operates, whether it's more staff support, committee hearings of record, what are improvements that you would recommend to make the legislative process more effective?
Well, that's an interesting. Well, first off, I think you're probably going to have a seniority system. I mean, that's just kind of the way things work. Which means that the Democrats are the ones with the kind of crummy offices because we're the minority, and the Republicans have better offices. But that's, I don't know. I don't know how you get around that. It's just something I think that's part of the nature of people. Probably in terms of staff support for committees, I think that might be a good idea. I don't know that we actually have as much support for either our own offices or for committees as we need it. So.
I'm new. This is my second year. I have a good office, so I like that. But with respect to the offices, they are going to be fixed within the next 2 years. Judy will be gone. But we have these areas that, and this is not meant to be, we call them the projects, and that's not meant to be negative or whatever, but they are. They're like these double-tiered things, and there are the ones on the top are really tiny, the ones on the bottom are really small. So the renovations that are going on at the Capitol now will take care of that, so that everyone will preferably have a decent size office, so that'll be resolved. It actually is kind of fun to be in that lottery system about getting your office. So with respect to staff, we do have a staffer for every committee. And that staffer is a nonpartisan person, and they are to keep you informed of what bills are being heard and draft the amendments that you want and walk you through that process as much as possible with telling you what's already out there and where this would go in our statutes and so forth. So I think to improve it, we could possibly have at least one more staffer a staff system that's only dedicated to the committees, but then the flip script, I'm a small business owner, then they wouldn't have any work to do after May the 17th. So our staffers double up as being committee employees as well as they are our research staff for the entire House as well. So probably we could add 2 to 4 more research staffers that will help us out. On budget, we have a full staff. The appropriation staff is the budget staff, and that's all they do. They're very, very competent, and they're very, very qualified, and it's a pretty great system that they have in budget. The only caveat is we're in the minority, so our issues aren't necessarily heard. In fact, at our hearing last week, no Democrats' amendments were approved to add to the budget. So you have to kind of do the networking, handshaking, behind-the-scenes procedure that you don't necessarily learn as soon as you get elected.
I'd like to say, I've, as far as I know, I've never missed a vote in my adult life. And this will show my ignorance, but how is it that the people of Missouri can vote overwhelmingly for things like ethics reform, and then nothing happens? How is that possible?
Well, in terms of, Clean Missouri, which is an amendment, it was a constitutional amendment to the Constitution. So that means it should be set in stone. You are quite right. And the legislature is taking some hits to it. I don't think they're going to do anything with the lobbyist gifts. I think they're going to leave it intact. Would you agree with that? Probably they're going to leave the lobbyist gifts intact. Probably the campaign contributions they're going to leave intact. The one that they seem to really have a big deal about is the transparency in terms of being having our emails open to the public. But I think eventually that will probably go to court and be overturned. The other one they seem to be bothered about is the redistricting process. And we have not heard a bill on the House floor yet, but I think there's maybe something in the works on that one. So it shouldn't be. And like many other things, if something is wrong, there is an appeal process. You can go to court and get it overturned. And I'm hopeful if they mess with Clean Missouri, that's what will happen. On the minimum wage, that was a statutory change. It was not a constitutional amendment. And with a statutory change, the legislature, unfortunately, legally can overturn it. So the bill we heard last week would allow private and religious schools to be exempt from the minimum wage law that we passed. I believe it was a straight party line vote. All Democrats voted against it, and all Republicans voted for it. I'm not sure where it's going to go over on the Senate side. I'm hoping we're going to be able to stop it over there. I'm sure the senators will be willing to wage a filibuster, I think, on anything that would go against the will of the voters on the minimum wage.
I agree. I think the couple of things that they're not going to mess with on Clean Missouri is primarily because those are things that would probably cost them votes in the 2020 election. It's interesting. I had a group of agriculture people, farmers, in my office, and they actually fell for the propaganda that was given them by their representatives as to why we're not making our records open. The Democrats have always been open to giving you whatever you want if you as a citizen or the media ask for freedom of information. We've always done that, even though we were not covered as elected representatives in the Sunshine Law. Clean Missouri made that so that we are now included in that. And within the first couple of weeks, we passed a bill out of the House. Again, it went pretty much party line that we, as representatives, can set our own rules. I'm not quite sure where that interpretation came from, because it clearly didn't come from the court, because nothing's been to the court about this. But they are really good at maximizing social media and making things sound rational to people who may not think, people who may not actually pick up a newspaper or watch a news show. They'll just believe, because if they see their representatives, they feel like their representatives speak for them, and that's all they need. Even though I tried, you know, I didn't waste my time trying to totally convince the woman that that was absolutely incorrect, but they there's a scare tactic used in a lot of the things that we are overturning that are the will of the voters.
Can I add one thing to that?
Sure.
I just want to add to it. It's interesting, on the minimum wage, 145 of the 163 legislative districts voted in favor of it, so it was overwhelming. And even the sponsors district of that particular bill that would have exempted religious and private schools, his district was 51.5, so still a majority voted in favor of it. My district was like 87% here in this district. But I think what happens is people say, well, why do people vote for these representatives when they vote for these ballot, and, you know, they want the minimum wage increase, but their representative votes against it? I think it's because they look at other stuff, and they look at, I think the two big issues to some folks are abortion and guns. And if their representative is good from their perspective on abortion and guns, they're going to stick with them, even if they aren't with them on some other things. So that's the only thing I can figure out from watching this for 7 years, that why these things happen like they do.
Okay, thank you. Representative Washington, this might be totally unfair to do to you right now, but could you take like just 2 minutes to describe, if you could pass, if you were guaranteed you could pass one bill through the legislature this term, what, that it was just going to be gifted to you, what would it be?
My bill would probably be to revamp the TIF process. And that would be, so it's a bill I filed. It's a bill that's probably not going anywhere because I'm not voting for something that the speaker wants. My bill would be to at least right now say that if you are in a plat of land, as you know, in all of Kansas City and elsewhere, on your property taxes, it has the description of the neighborhood you actually live in. So even though you may say you live South Plaza, you may live in Cumberland or whatever. So if Cumberland or whatever, the make-believe plat of land, has a TIF and they don't pay taxes for 25 years, then everybody that touches that, their taxes are at least frozen for the same 25 years, so that you are not forced to incur the tax increase that is going to come from the people that can afford to buy a $2 million house and pay zero taxes. So that would be my dream gift.
That would be my dream bill. Thank you very much.
Yeah, like Kansas has kind of went to kind of blue when they've been red all these years. Do you see any possibility that there are issues in Missouri that could be overreach and cause Missourians to embrace Democrats a little more than in the past?
Yes. Like I said, never give up, never give out, never give in. And I think at some point that I think it'll sway back, and we will be able to take some of these seats back. I think the most important one to take back is the governor right now. I think it's really important to have a governor on your side. I think that's very important. But if I had one bill to pass, I think it would be Medicaid expansion. That would be the one that I would. Yeah.
Sure. Go ahead.
To answer his last question about the Democrat issues, part of what we have to do is we have to go out and educate those that are not traditionally Democrats. Because if we look at this, it's only been this skewed since the 2000s. We were in charge, which means Missourians do want to be with us. So unlike my colleague, I want to take back the Secretary of State, because the Secretary of State, as we definitely, I think the Georgia situation for governor made me look at that. Stacey Abrams was never, ever, 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 ever going to win. And that is because that Secretary of State spent his 8 years in office purging the rolls of the voters and doing redistricting and gerrymandering that would hurt those voters. When I go to Southeast Missouri, the Boot Hill, and I see a whole lot of people that look like me, and a whole lot of those people are poor, and they still work on farms, I know they're not Republicans. And when they tell me that, when I live, unfortunately, like we do Troost here, when I live across the street, I'm in a different rep district. They basically have made a cross in the middle of that those communities down there, and so that there is no pocket of Democrats that can vote together. We should easily have two representatives down there, and probably two African-Americans because of the population there. But they've separated them out so that people who live in the same community aren't voting for the same people.
Okay, help me thank the representatives. I really appreciate you coming this morning. Representative Washington, will you be able to come to the library for a few minutes, or do you? Okay. So if people have other questions that they want to ask, we'll be back there for about 20 minutes. Next week, Hate Busters bring people together. Ed Chastain will be here. You're welcome to stay for the service today. Thank you very much for coming. Oh, the mugs. We certainly appreciate you coming. So, all right, cobalt blue money. Remember your time with us, and we hope that'll inspire you to come back, because there's much more we want to hear from both of you. Thank you all.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Effectiveness of the Kansas City Metro Vote, with Representatives Judy Morgan and Barbara Washington. This program was recorded on Sunday, March 17th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 1 day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.